I know it's very difficult to take time out of your day to come to a lunch and a debate and take time out of your schedule, and especially for those of you who don't work downtown, it's a trek, I know. And I know Mr. Smith made his way over from Ann Arbor. I don't know if anybody has a further award, but I know he's from Ann Arbor, so he might get the, other than our speakers, the first person award. So it's great to have everybody here. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Randy Gilmer. I am currently the president of the Lawyers Society, although they're getting ready to impeach me, I think, in a couple months here. So, yes, and but our Matthew Schneider will be our incoming president.
So,
and for those of you who may have seen, I've put at your table a white paper that was just written by Mr. Schneider, professor of law at Cooley, adjunct visiting professor at Cooley. It's a wonderful paper regarding the history of the Supreme Court and you know, the parallels between the current majority on the Supreme Court and the, you know, the four horsemen back in the day that people think about, trying to correct a lot of the wrongs of the stereotypes about this court, about their activist court, because look at how many cases that they've reversed since they've been on the court, but they never like to point out that that's because the cases they're reversing, then in and of themselves, there was no reason for those cases to have been voted the way they went down, and it was trying to correct the many years of wrongs that were passed on when we had a activist court before them. So some very good reading in your spare time. And we are delighted to have with us today Professor Doug Komet and Wendy Long, our speakers for today. Professor Komet is currently the constitutional law chair at Pepperdine Law School, and before entering academics, he was an assistant attorney general at the Office of Legal Counsel under President Reagan and President George H.W. Bush. Professor Komet has recently surprised legal conservatives by his endorsement of Barack Obama, and he brought a copy of the book so you can see it. He doesn't have any others. He says that it's because the publisher couldn't get them to him. I think he was concerned that we might tear them up, and I'm not sure. He said that you can find them on Amazon and, you know, Amazon.com and other places, and, you know, you can either buy it full price this week or wait until Wednesday and either pay more or less, depending on Tuesday. So we have him, and then we also have with us Wendy Long. Wendy, thank you for coming. She is the legal counsel for the Judicial Confirmation Network. And until March of 2005, she was litigation partner at the New York office of Kirkland & Ellis. So if I remember where everybody is and where they came from, you both then have had the opportunity to either work for or work with Ken Starr at various times during your career, or at least connections too. And Wendy is here to give the anti-Obama speech or the McCain speech, so to speak. As you know, that we pride ourselves in, as a debate society, we give both sides of the coin, and at this time, I turn the floor over to Wendy. Thank you.
I'll borrow Wendy's applause.
Just wanted to make sure they made you feel welcome.
Thank you, Randy, and thank you for Wendy for being a participant and for lending me your applause. It is an unusual endorsement that I've made. It's an unusual path that I have followed this year. Susan at my lunch table figured out the entire motivation. And it's a motivation that really comes out of disappointment rather than and concern. And that is that our party at first principle has not honored the principles that brought me into government, did not honor the principles of the separation of powers in terms of the way in which the presidency was managed. One can think of any one of a number of examples. I think in particular of the dismissal of the U.S. attorneys. U.S. attorneys are enormously important to the integrity of the legal system. I was a defender of the presidency for Ronald Reagan and the first President Bush. I took that responsibility seriously. And of course, the president had unfettered ability to dismiss U.S. attorneys as he wanted. That wasn't the question. The question was the prudence of the act. And dismissing U.S. attorneys midterm without any sufficient thought or justification, and indeed delegating it to a much too young associate to have that grave responsibility seemed to me to be a grave mistake for the legal system. I also have considerable doubt about our course in Iraq. I was a defender of the war, as a good loyal soldier of the president initially. When it turned out that our intelligence was wrong on weapons of mass destruction and the relationship, as the 9/11 Commission demonstrated, to Al-Qaeda, it seemed to me that we had an opportunity, a small window of opportunity, to reduce the impact of our occupation and to reduce the destruction of that society. We chose not to do that, and I'm deeply concerned as to what our motivation for that was. It is now costing us far too much in lives, over 4,000 American lives, thousands of Iraqi lives, $10 billion a month in expenditures. That's something we as Republicans, as conservatives, have to answer for. And of course, we also have to answer for the fiscal irresponsibility that our government has indulged. We are deeply in debt to nations that we have great concern about in terms of the March of Freedom. There are over $500 billion in debt to China alone for the expenditures of the war. This is not something that I view as in keeping with the Reagan legacy. I mentioned just a moment ago that one of the things that Ronald Reagan was proudest of, and that I was very grateful to have been a part of during those years, was that the president would always say, "Well, I think we made them feel better about themselves." And he would say that over and over again. And he would mean that. And he would mean that not just in a superficial sense, in a celluloid sense, because the one thing that Ronald Reagan was not was celluloid. He was accused of being celluloid. He was accused of just being a film star. He was accused of just somebody handing him a script. He was the real deal. We know that from the yellow pad on which he wrote his own speeches and the sentiment that he brought to tearing down that wall, Mr. Gorbachev, into every similar episode that we remember as the hallmark of freedom in those years. I yearn for those years. I wish the Republicans had nominated a leader of that stature. Unfortunately, my experience in the primary working for Mitt Romney gave me an up-close and personal look at your nominee, and excuse me for not knowing the pronouns, and it was not one that was his moment of honor. He is an honorable man. He is a good man, but he has not campaigned to his own stature. And that, if anything else, it seems to me, will account for what I think will be an unfortunate loss of the McCain contribution to the United States next Tuesday. The one thing I don't dissent from the current administration is the role of the president in his responsibility as the nominator and appointer of men and women to the bench. I think, by and large, the men and women that have been appointed by George W. Bush to the federal bench during his term of office have been excellent. They have been men and women of competence, of integrity, of judgment, of commitment to the rule of law, who embody, indeed, the essential attributes of why this society exists. A reminder that we are a limited government, that we are a government of law, that we expect our judges to act within the scope of their judicial responsibilities and not farther, and that, by and large, that's exactly what they've done. I've been especially proud, as I know you have, of the two appointees of the Bush administration to the court. I have a special fondness for these men since I started in the Justice Department with both of them. John Roberts was a special assistant In those days, he was always upwardly mobile. Sam Alito and I, who started at the same time, could see that in him. We knew he was destined to go to the White House while the two of us would stay back, laboring in the Justice Department. And that's fine. He was meant to go higher. And he's a fine manager for the Supreme Court, and we're obviously greatly advantaged to have him on the bench. And Sam Alito was my office partner. Indeed, we shared an office, and there's nothing like sharing an office with Sam Alito. He is a brilliant man. He's a careful man. He's someone who really knows statutory and constitutional interpretation like none other, because he spends the time. He really does look for the ultimate purpose behind an enactment in its meaning as given in the words of the statute. And to watch him do that is a great pleasure. It wasn't always a pleasure to have him plunk down in a chair in my office at the end of the day, and with that kind of haggard Alito look with his arm off to the side saying, "Ugh, can't believe what they tried to pull off on us today," or some such comment. But he's a Phillies fan, and I have to believe that he's pretty happy right this moment. So I have no dissent in terms of the men and women brought to the bench. And of course, we can see the positive effects on the court itself. John Roberts has made, in the true Hamiltonian sense, the Supreme Court the least dangerous branch by making it the least heard from branch. Last year, there was 67 decided cases on its merits, the lowest number in generations. I don't want to suggest that they should just go out of work and all go to the ballpark, but I do think they have to be judicious about the cases that they take, and they ought not to be looking for opportunities to invent rights or to lead the republic when the republic is intended to be a democratic republic and not a republic of crown princes. I think the method that the Roberts Court has hit upon for purposes of implementing the least dangerous branch, the distinction between facial and as-applied analysis is a useful analysis. As you may know from the last term, in about a half a dozen or more cases, very important cases, the Supreme Court utilized this distinction to say that the law was constitutional on its face, and of course it's very difficult, appropriately so, to invalidate a law on its face, because you have to prove that it has no conceivable constitutional application. That ought to be a very unreachable standard, and the way in which the court has applied it has been to uphold statutes, including, among other controversial statutes, the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act, on its face, leaving to the lower courts the application of the statute in particular circumstances to know whether the particular health exception or definition of the procedure in the statute is sufficient to meet the constitutional claim. Now, this imposes even greater work, of course, on the federal appellate bench, and they rightly deserve a raise, and the Chief Justice has appropriately been asking for one on their behalf, and unfortunately, the Congress of the United States has been extraordinarily ungenerous to these men and women who have given up considerable opportunity costs by taking on this role of public service and who work extremely hard, especially out there in the Ninth Circuit, for very little honor or recognition. Indeed, if you're in the Ninth Circuit, the only recognition you get is that you're the most diverse circuit in the United States. And part of it is overwork, but part of it is just we've got some interesting people on the Ninth Circuit. So I have my dissent with the current administration for its failings on what I think are good Republican terms. I have my praise for the current administration in terms of its role in the judiciary. I do have a positive case for Barack Obama. I do think that Senator Obama is a remarkable leader. I've had occasion now to meet with him a number of times where I've taken him to task for, among other things, for the way in which he's approached the right to life issue, because this is an issue of great importance to me as a Catholic and as an American citizen. I at first didn't think I was capable of endorsing the senator because of that view, but one of the things that I think Senator Obama is very good at is trying to find common ground, even over the most divisive subject. And that's the great hope, I think, of his presidency, that his background of being both black and white, his background of being both Christian and Muslim, his background of being both of the baby boom generation and not of the baby boom generation, his background in so many ways exemplifies his own philosophy of government. It's a philosophy of government that says we shouldn't denigrate or demonize our opponent. We shouldn't try and win by making the other person small or excluded. We should try and find where it is that we have some basis of agreement, even on a sensitive subject such as abortion. And he opened my own perspective to something that I spend a lot of time in the book, and that is the concern that we're just simply not making the progress that we should have made over the last 35 years in restoring the right to life to the Constitution of the United States. And there's no, in my judgment, there's no excuse that we are where we are. That, you know, it's sometimes casually said that we're one vote away. In all honesty, out of the qualities that I respect of the Supreme Court that I've just enumerated, I don't think we are one vote away. Because as an institutional matter, I think Justice Roberts and Justice Alito will have serious concern about reintroducing the Supreme Court of the United States to a larger role on that subject. One of the things that Casey versus Planned Parenthood has done has led to a kind of equipoise, where the states are given an opportunity to regulate the practice in a way that largely coincides, it seems to me, with the kind of general perspective of the Republic as to the right of the woman to make this decision up to a point on her own and the right of the state to protect the interests of unborn life thereafter. That's not the principal position of my church, which sees life beginning at the moment of conception until the moment of natural death and every point in between. But as Senator Obama is frequent to point out to your humble servant, he's not running to be president of the United States Catholic Church. He's running to be president of the United States. And there are other faith traditions worthy of our respect and concern. The Jewish tradition, the Methodist tradition, to some degree the Presbyterian tradition, all of whom see the right to life in a different way, see life beginning at a different point. And to the extent that we honor the free exercise of religion, and we should, there's an obligation on the part of the government to do so as well. So one of the things that Senator Obama has convinced me of is his sincerity in wanting to address the root causes of this unfortunate, tragic practice in our life. And the root causes of that are, as we know from empirical study, frequently poverty. Women in poverty are four times more likely to pursue an abortion than women outside of poverty. And so Senator Obama says we can't just ignore the fact that these women don't have health care, can't just ignore the fact that many of them are just eking out an existence for themselves. Oftentimes shelter is not readily available, but we can come alongside them with a reasonable amount of federal resources for maternity care, for prenatal and postnatal care, for income support. And we ought to think about the cost of adoption. I mean, any of you who have adopted know that the costs are astronomical. We're talking in the $10,000, $11,000, $15,000, $16,000, $20,000 range. There's a large number of people in this society who want to adopt, who want to welcome children into their home, either because they've already had children themselves and want to extend their home to others as well, or because they haven't been able to have children, and we ought to facilitate that. And we say that over and over again. I believe Senator Obama is actually prepared to do something about it. Now, one of the things that I think is probably on your mind is what is the impact on Senator Obama on the Supreme Court of the United States, or what is the comparative impact? Now, this is a sophisticated group, so I won't discuss this issue at length in the way that it sometimes gets discussed, which is in an outcome-based manner. For example, in the Saddleback Church Forum earlier in the summer, there was a question asked of both of the candidates, who would you not have nominated from the people currently on the bench? I was at the Saddleback Forum, and I wanted to rise up and say, I object. This is an improper question, and I direct my witnesses to answer, because it is, in essence, the kind of question that just simply is designed to undercut the integrity and the honor and the respect we should have for the sitting members of the court. With all due respect to Pastor Warren, of the splendid questions he asked that afternoon, this was not one of them. Even worse were the answers given by the two political candidates, including my own. My own chose to suggest that Justice Thomas would have been somebody he would not have appointed. As I told him personally, and as I told the press, because I didn't want him to think that his punishment was just going to be a personal conversation, Justice Thomas is one of the finest members of the court, who indeed has a true grasp of the natural law, understanding of the Constitution and the relationship between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. To single him out is to single out perhaps the brightest star on the team, and it's just simply not appropriate. Now, I could make sense of Senator Obama's comment. You know, Justice Thomas's experience on the bench prior to appointment was thin, right? He had only been on the court a handful of years. But goodness knows that's not the way in which we've appointed people over time, so I don't give it credit. Senator McCain's answers, I thought, were equally unpalatable. He just simply searched his mind for the four people that somebody told him were the liberal members of the court, and he said he wouldn't have appointed them. And, of course, the consequence of that meant that the people he would not have appointed would not have defended the United States flag from flag burning. Justice Stevens dissented from that opinion, appropriately so, in a brilliant dissent, far more brilliant than the concurrence of Justice Scalia on that occasion, he would have dissented from the appointment of the man who would have allowed the FCC to protect our children from explicit sexual material in the sense that he would have imposed upon the cable stations responsibility to make sure there isn't something called cable bleed. The only justice who had the correct view of that, it seems to me, was Justice Breyer. And, of course, he was one of the people who would have been eliminated, too. And you can go right down the list. He would have eliminated Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which means he would have eliminated most of the jurisprudence about the equality of women under the Equal Protection Clause. That seems to me to be not what Senator McCain would actually want if he would think about it, but that when you give this kind of caricature-like answer in terms of outcome, that's what we did. And I think it's unfortunate in our political dialogue that in terms of the court, we get answers like this. So let's go a little bit deeper, more serious answers about this issue. I do have one more bone to pick on Senator McCain before I leave him alone, and that is somebody wrote a speech for him early in the campaign at Wake Forest University about the federal judiciary. If I was a member of the federal judiciary, I'd sue for libel, because the claim that there was rampant judicial activism on the federal bench just seemed to be enormously overstated. I mean, one of the things I like best about the Federalist Society, especially events like this and the National Convention events, is that we do get down into the particulars. We have panels that get into the specific, and we don't paint with this broad brush. whoever wrote that speech for him painted with such a sprayer that every member of the bench seemed to me to have reason to be offended. But I'll put that to one side because I don't think the senator actually wrote that himself. I do think the senator has a desire, like I think everyone in this room has, to promote the rule of law and to avoid judicial activism. What does it mean to promote the rule of law and avoid judicial activism? Well, I take it means that you don't deliberately misconstrue a statute. And one can point to a number of areas of jurisprudence. I would point to some of the jurisprudence dealing with Title IX as jurisprudence that did deliberately misconstrue the statute. You don't disregard the actual meaning of history. So, for example, in the religion clause area, one of the cases that is a seminal case of mischief that puts us on the path of excluding religion rather than protecting religion is the Everson versus the Board of Education case. It was a case about bus rides and whether or not bus rides could be even-handedly given to people in parochial as well as public schools. It was a simple case. There was no establishment clause problem in it. The court could have resolved it that way, and its holding is, in fact, that, but its rationale gives rise to the modern establishment clause jurisprudence, which, frankly, is a mess, right? And it depends upon somebody named the reasonable objective observer who hangs around in Sandra O'Connor's garage, and you bring him out to ask whether or not he's offended by 10 commandments, 5 commandments, or something in between, and only when you have him opining do you have an outcome. That's not the way to treat something as important as religious belief. Judicial activism is also the invention of rights. One can point to Roe itself. One might even point to Lawrence versus Texas. One might point to, even more sensitively, for some Republicans, the invention of limits on punitive damages. This is an exercise of substantive due process as well. We have splaining to do, as Ricky would say to Lucy, when we take advantage of the substantive due process rationale for our benefit, but criticize it on the other side. So what's Obama's, let me finish by asking just directly, what's Obama said about who he's going to appoint to the court? Some wiseacres said, well, Kamek's endorsing Obama because he knows, you know, the Democrats are going to win. He's getting old. This is his last chance to get on the court. That had to, the laughter that had to provoke in Washington, D.C. at the People for the American Way had to be so resounding that the laughter, you know, would have reached Detroit. So obviously I don't really have that conflict of interest. And if I would ask Mrs. Kamek if she wanted to move to Washington from Malibu, she would think that issue the dissent the end all dissents. So who has Senator Obama, or what criteria has Senator Obama held out for his criteria for appointment? Obviously competence and integrity, these are given. Nobody's going to dissent on that. Yeah, he has outlined as well what he describes and what would be described in the scholarly literature as problem solving, as pragmatic evaluation of the consequences of legal rulings, and he holds out as his exemplar Justice Breyer. This would not be the person that I would necessarily think of in terms of the ideal that I would have, if I was President of the United States, looking for. But it's also, I think, not an indefensible ideal, because Justice Breyer really is somebody who tries to assess, take, for example, his dissenting opinion in Eldred versus Ashcroft dealing with the mindless extension of the copyright provision. He tries to fashion an outcome for the court that reasonably takes into account the economic impact of mindlessly extending copyright in terms of how that would dampen, give too great a monopoly to intellectual property to create incentives for people to produce, and at the same time gives enough incentive. So this is the kind of justice that Senator Obama has held out to us. He also has held out that on occasion he, of course, expects what we all expect, that the court will be the defender of minority rights, that the court will come to the assistance of those who have been oppressed by majority decision-making. And he holds out an example that I don't think any of us would dissent from, Brown versus the Board of Education. But he also says in the same breath that Brown is a landmark case because it comes with rarity, right? That the justices are not on the lookout constantly for a way to lead the democratic process. They're on the lookout for a place where the voting structures or the civil rights structures or the way in which the democratic process has conducted itself, as the late John Hart Ely used to say, has conducted itself in a way that has left some people out. And so his last criteria, which sometimes gets mocked, but I don't think should be mocked, is empathy. The ability to see that at some point, the law runs out. Right? The statute takes you so far, the legislative history takes you so far, and then choices have to be made. And those choices inevitably can be choices that are somewhat ideological, or choices that advance the underlying purpose and goal of the statute. Just one example, and I'll sit down so that Wendy can have the balance of the time and then we can have some time for questions. He holds out the case of Ledbetter versus Goodyear, a case dealing with statute of limitations for a Title VII cause of action. Now, my good friend Sam Alito decided that. He decided it in a way that I think is entirely defensible. Indeed, I've tried to make good use of that precedent in my own litigation before the Federal Circuit and elsewhere, not successfully, by the way. And because they want to confine the litigation to civil rights as opposed to other areas. But the essential question there was, when does a civil rights cause of action accrue, and does it reaccrue with every, if somebody is discriminated against on the basis of gender at the initial hiring date, and then their paychecks reflect that discrimination over and over and over again, is each paycheck a starting of the statute of limitations or not? And Justice Alito decided that it was the not. But if you look at that case, and you look carefully at that case, you'll see that the precedent on that was quite divided and quite close, and that it could just as easily have been resolved the other way. Now I ask you, in terms of the ultimate purpose of that statute, to give remedy for purposes of gender discrimination against, as well as other forms of discrimination, whether or not, when the law has run out in that circumstance, being cognizant of that statutory purpose doesn't put you on the opposite side from which Justice Alito ruled. I don't think it's a fatuous question to ask, and it's the kind of question that I think Senator Obama would want his nominees to answer. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Wendy. Thank you, everyone, for coming, your hospitality, and thank you, Doug, too, for being here. I guess I'll start first with my positive statement that I wanted to make, my initial presentation rather than my rebuttal, which is that Doug's presentation of Barack Obama's positions, and even Obama's positions as he presents them, call to mind what one scholar said of Alexander Pope's translation of the Iliad. It's a pretty poem, Mr. Pope, but you must not call it Homer. It's a pretty picture, and it's pretty to think that Obama's positions square in any way with our written Constitution, an originalist interpretation of it, respect for democratic self-government, or a limited judicial role. The problem with this pretty picture that Doug has painted is that it's contradicted by a mountain of evidence that wouldn't survive a summary judgment motion in an impartial federal court. The 2008 presidential election, as we all know, is going to have a big impact on all the federal courts and the Supreme Court in particular. And I'm going to be overly simplistic here, and Doug has pointed out that it is overly simplistic, to paint the current divide on the court as quite as stark as both of the political candidates do at times, and even the candidate who Doug and I both worked for, Mitt Romney, who said things that are virtually identical to the things that John McCain said in the Wake Forest speech. But given the advancing age of so many justices and roughly the 4-4 split, sometimes 5-4 split in favor of the judicial activist wing of the court, and the four who are, you know, reliable proponents of judicial restraint, it's likely that a President Obama or President McCain is going to have a very decisive effect on the court through his appointments, and it could affect the court for the bulk of this century and the Constitution for even longer than that. So I want to submit to you sitting here a summary judgment motion. I submit there's no genuine issue of material fact that Barack Obama is a radical liberal extremist when it comes to the court and the Constitution, and that his judges would do great damage to the rule of law, to the principles of American justice, and to our inalienable right to life, liberty, and property. There are 7 basic points I want to make in this motion. The first one is, Obama unabashedly embraces judicial activism, which I think we can agree is roughly defined as a judge deciding on the basis of what he thinks is right rather than what the law actually says. Obama describes his ideal of justice, as Doug alluded to, as somebody who's got heart and empathy to recognize, I'm quoting here, what it's like to be a young teenage mom, the empathy to understand what it's like to be poor, African-American, gay, disabled, or old. Empathy is obviously a great quality, great human quality. We all admire it. We all want to live it in our lives. But apparently in Senator Obama's America, there are certain categories of litigants in whose favor federal judges are supposed to rule. And, of course, it's not a federal judge's job to side with anyone, but to rule impartially based on the law. Obama's words are really a caricature of the most extreme ideal of judicial activism. Obama's ideal is the opposite of the model of Lady Justice blindfolded, to emphasize that the judge isn't supposed to have passion for any one party, but is to be utterly dispassionate and to uphold us as a nation of laws and not of men. Obama would basically have federal judges violate the oath they take to administer justice without respect to persons. Point number 2. Obama voted in the U.S. Senate against Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. These are 2 outstanding judicial nominees. Doug knows them better, far better than I do, and he very well, I think, stated their virtues. But there's a big problem, Doug. Senator Obama voted against them. He doesn't agree with you. He said he didn't think that Chief Justice Roberts had the right heart and that he had too often used his powers on behalf of the strong in opposition to the weak. Obama claimed that your good colleague, Sam Alito, quote, consistently sighs on behalf of the powerful against the powerless, again, same theme, and gave us as examples, criticized Alito's rulings in favor of employers over employees, prosecutors over defendants, and said that Justice Alito believes, quote, in the overarching power of the president to engage in whatever the president deems to be appropriate policy. Talk about overstated campaign rhetoric. We all know this is a grossly inaccurate description of Justice Alito's record of decision-making. It's an unfair characterization of the life's work of a man who's been scrupulously fair and impartial by all accounts, by his fellow judges, law clerks, and litigants, everyone who's appeared before him. What's even more troubling is that it leads the American people to believe what Senator Obama apparently believes, which is that judging is all about whose side you're on. It's all about who wins. It's all about what type of litigant wins and what side wins. It's completely outcome-oriented, and the fact that he's saying this, I think, is misleading the American public about what the rule of law really is. Doug told the Wall Street Journal what he said here today, that Justice Roberts and Alito were unparalleled, superb quality appointments, and he also said that he viewed those appointments not as partisan appointments, but rather as justices who would remove politics from the court. And Doug, I think you're exactly right when you say that. But the man that you're endorsing with the expectation he'll be making decisive future appointments to the Supreme Court doesn't agree with you. He sees these appointments of Roberts and Alito as very political, and he treats his own prospective appointments as even more political. With regard to John McCain's Wake Forest speech, Joan McCain upheld Justice Robertson Alito as the model of the kind of appointments he would make. He contrasted their humility and impartial decision-making with that of judicial activist judges. And for his clarification of this, I think he's doing the voters a service to clarify what the distinctions are between the two candidates, what the distinctions are between the two broad modes of constitutional decision-making. And Doug, you accused him of scare tactics. Again, he was saying basically the same thing that our old candidate, Mitt Romney, used to say. I think it's clear that Barack Obama's votes against Robertson Alito, McCain's votes for them, and naming him as the model of justice as he appoints, is at the core of what these two men would mean for the Constitution. It embodies the heart of the debate that crystallized, and Doug, I know you were there at the heart of this debate, about 20 years ago when Ed Meese, Ronald Reagan's Attorney General, advanced the jurisprudence of originalism, the idea that judges should decide cases based upon the text and principles of the Constitution as the authors and ratifiers of the Constitution understood it. The opposing model, and the one who came to be a great antagonist to Ed Meese, was the late Justice William Brennan, who was in favor of a different model called the Living Constitution. And then that model is precisely what Barack Obama's talking about. It's a justice using basically his heart and his empathy and what he thinks is right instead of the law to decide a case. My former boss, Justice Clarence Thomas, has referred to the Brennan-Obama approach as making it up. Justice Thomas also had a great way of expressing this with a sign in his chambers you may have heard about that said, "Please do not emanate into the penumbra." Point number three. Senator Obama not only voted against these two fine nominees to the Supreme Court, but he went so far as to try to filibuster Justice Alito, along with a lot of President Bush's outstanding nominees to the federal appellate courts. Obstructing and filibustering highly qualified judges, men and women of integrity, is not being a uniter, it's not trying to find common ground on divisive issues, it's not even basic fairness. It is the most partisan, unfair behavior that we've seen in the Senate. And Obama has played the most vicious partisan game in town when it comes to savaging any important judicial nominee whose appointment the far-left groups want to kill. I will give you a case in point. Judge Leslie Southwick, whom President Bush nominated to the Fifth Circuit. The year before, the Senate Judiciary Committee had approved Judge Southwick's nomination unanimously to the Federal District Court. Southwick never got a floor vote because the prior nominee to the Fifth Circuit, a man named Michael Wallace, was obstructed for equally specious reasons, the one you're about to hear. Judge Southwick received the ABA Judicial Evaluation Committee's recommendation of unanimously well-qualified, and I cite this not because I think the ABA should be any kind of threshold for picking judges, but just to show you that this well-acknowledged liberal body thought unanimously that Judge Southwick was well-qualified for the bench. He served 11 years as a Mississippi appellate judge. He was a senior justice department in the Bush 41 administration, adjunct professor of law for a decade, and had 2 decades of experience in private practice. Not only that, but Judge Southwick had enrolled in the Army Reserve at age 42, and at age 54, volunteered for active duty in Iraq, coming back 2 years later. And for his service to our country, Senator Obama slandered this man with completely unfounded sneers and tried to filibuster and kill his nomination. What did he say? Obama said, quote, that Judge Southwick's nomination threatens the very basis of our freedom and democracy. Why? Because Judge Southwick, you've heard this before, didn't side frequently enough with consumers, employees, I'm quoting, racial minorities, women, gays, and lesbians. And indeed, Obama said he had, quote, shown hostility to their rights. Out of more than 7,000 cases that Judge Southwick decided as a state appellate judge in Mississippi, Obama and his Senate colleagues picked out 2 that revealed Southwick's supposed unfitness for the federal bench. Case number 1. Obama accused Judge Southwick basically of being a racist for no reason other than that he correctly applied the standards of deference under state administrative law. Here was the case. A Mississippi state employee had made a racial slur, basically calling one of his fellow black employee, the N-word. Then an administrative board found the employee who uttered the slur should not be fired because it was an isolated incident. It was not a repeat offense or a pattern. Judge Southwick and the Mississippi Appellate Court majority ruled, as the law required them to, that because there was sufficient evidence for the administrative board's determination, the court, as a matter of law, could not return it. In other words, Judge Southwick faithfully followed the law. Obama attacked him, saying Southwick couldn't be fair in civil rights cases and intimating that he was a racist. Case number two, the second case over which Obama and his colleague attacked Southwick was a child custody case, in which the Court of Appeals of Mississippi reviewed a ruling by a chancery court giving custody of a child to her father rather than her mother. By a vote of 8-2, Judge Southwick and the majority of the court affirmed the chancery court's ruling. Again, Judge Southwick was called upon to apply a deferential standard and could overturn the chancellor's ruling only if it was manifestly wrong, clearly erroneous, or applied an erroneous legal standard. And the mother had argued that the chancery court improperly gave weight to her lesbian conduct and relationships. The majority cited and applied governing Mississippi Supreme Court precedent that said a parent's homosexuality can be properly considered and weighed as a factor in custody determinations. But what did Obama say about this? He said the case demonstrated that Judge Southwick would be a threat to democracy and the very basis of our freedom. Point number four in my motion. Obama also voted against many outstanding judicial nominees, including William Pryor for the 11th Circuit, Priscilla Owen for the 5th Circuit, and Judge Janice Rogers Brown for the D.C. Circuit. These are all judges who upheld the rule of law, practiced judicial restraint, are men and women of integrity for the bench. But for the reasons like those advanced in the Southwick nomination, Obama said no. Point number five, and this is going to be about the Saddleback Forum, when asked what justices he would not appoint, Senator Obama chose to demean Justice Clarence Thomas, saying not only that he, quote, profoundly disagrees with his interpretation of the Constitution, but that Justice Thomas lacked the intellectual and judicial ability of the young court, a criticism that Obama leveled only at Thomas, and not at his white colleagues, Roberts, Alito, and Scalia. And this is really inexcusable for anyone, but especially for Obama, who's a constitutional law scholar, and one would presume actually reads Supreme Court opinions, unlike Harry Reid, who made a similar slur against Justice Thomas. And I think what it really shows is what we've seen from his behavior on nominations, that Obama is really a puppet of the far left-wing interest groups when it comes to the court and when it comes to judicial nominations. It's a very monolithic way of thinking, and it is the antithesis, really, of independent, critical thinking. I guess, so Senator Obama wasn't interested, for example, when the papers of late Justice Harry Blackmun came out. ABC News reporter Jan Greenberg researched them and actually wrote a book that encapsulated a lot of them, showing that Justice Thomas, and I know you know this, Doug, but showing the public that Justice Thomas was an intellectual leader from the very first week he got on the court. In the conferences judges had, he was changing minds, he was turning Scalia around, turning Rehnquist around, making new majorities, and I saw that also when I clerked for him. Point number six, Obama has vowed repeated fealty to Roe v. Wade, the worst Supreme Court decision and perversion of our Constitution since Dred Scott, which 35 years ago denied the American people the ability to protect a whole class of human beings, which has now given us the most radical abortion regime in the civilized world. In the name of preserving Roe, what has Obama done? One, he's voted repeatedly against a ban on partial birth abortion and condemned the U.S. Supreme Court's decision upholding legislation that expressed the vast majority of Americans' revulsion of that practice. And then he's voted four times against protecting infants who are actually born alive. This is the Illinois state legislator. Either as a result of a botched abortion that failed to produce a dead baby, or by the deliberate delivery of a baby before the presumed time of viability. So he voted four times against that legislation. He then lied about it, about the circumstances and the reasons for it, twice about why he supported infanticide. And the last time was in the third and final presidential debate. And point number seven, Obama's policy positions do violence to the first and most important function of government, the protection and preservation of human life and the individual worth and dignity of every person. Obama promises that his first act as president will be to sign the Freedom of Choice Act, which would create a federally guaranteed fundamental right to abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy, abolishing virtually every existing state and federal limitation on abortion, which are already pretty meager, including parental consent and notification laws for minors, state and federal taxpayer funding restrictions, and conscience protection laws for pro-life citizens and institutions, such as Catholic hospitals, who would be forced against their will to participate in abortions. So in conclusion, my main point here, and my motion, I think it's ironic that for all of Senator Obama's attacks on good and honorable judges like Roberts, Alito, and Southwick, for purportedly failing to uphold equal protection of laws for the powerless, sadly, I think it's really under President Obama that the weakest and most vulnerable and powerless members of the human family would have no rights at all that the rest of us are bound to respect. Now, with respect to Doug's comments, I've already hit on the main one here, which is that he said he was attracted to Obama because he was such a remarkable leader, and his prime virtue in this regard was that he was good at trying to find common ground. I hope you can see that his behavior on judicial nominees has been anything but that. And it is certainly not, I don't think, Doug, as you said, a philosophy of government that doesn't demonize or demean your opponent, because that's precisely what he did to Roberts, Alito, Southwick, and other judicial nominees. I'm sad to hear, and many of Doug's former friends and colleagues are sad, that Doug has these disappointments with his party, with the current administration. We all certainly had disappointments with the current administration. But I think that the main observation I have to make about Doug's initial point is that there doesn't seem to be a cause and effect between his disappointments and what he's decided to do about them. When we have these disappointments, whether it's because Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez mishandled the U.S. attorney firings or whatever they are, we try to work to strengthen within our own party to believe the core principles that we believe in. We don't turn our back and abandon it and walk into someone who's been hostile and antagonistic to everything that we've been working for. And Doug, you've been working for these things far longer than I have. I think this isn't a debate about the war in Iraq or about the national debt or anything like that, but I would say on any of these things, we'll see if President Obama's elected, whether we're better in 4 years or 8 years on any of those things. I would venture to guess that we probably won't be. And specifically on the number of lives that have been lost in the war, you've advanced this idea that the number of lives that are lost is somehow disrespectful to human life, and particularly from the Catholic angle. Well, we've lost 40 million innocent lives so far to abortion. We've lost lives in every war. I certainly don't think that it's reasonable to say that those wars that were fought for a noble purpose shouldn't have been fought. On the point about Ronald Reagan and his making us feel better about ourselves, I think that's very inappropriate to apply to Obama. I'm sure Obama would like us to feel better about ourselves, and that's the prettiness of this picture that I was referring to in my opening. It's a very pretty picture, but there's nothing to feel good about. Feeling good doesn't exist in a vacuum. Ronald Reagan wanted us to feel good about real principles and real truths that he was upholding. Barack Obama doesn't stand for any of those truths that Ronald Reagan was upholding. And let's see, what else? Well, with regard to the comment, Doug, that you made about empathy, I mean, this really is the word that Obama has brought up over and over again. I'm very surprised to hear you say that at some point the law runs out. That has been an article of faith for us for a generation now, us originalists, that there is an answer in the law. There is a right answer. And Justice Thomas drilled us into us as law clerks. He said, there is a right answer. Sometimes you have to dig deep for it. Sometimes it's not right on the face of the Constitution. Sometimes you have to study the principles. Sometimes you have to go back to England, look at the common law. Sometimes you have to do a lot more to find the right answer. But there is a right answer. It's not just that there's a dead end and we can't reason anymore and we can't search anymore and get to a right answer. So I disagree with you very much that the law runs out. I disagree with Senator Obama that we have to substitute empathy and partiality in our courts.
we are in need of penance. And more so than we can't just let ourselves easily off the hook about this. Because these are real lives. This is the truth of the human person that we have in front of us. When those students of mine didn't return from Iraq, I had to explain to their mothers and fathers, as did their United States government, as to why it is that they were asked to serve. I have great respect for every person who has been asked to serve and who has served. But, you know, the responsibility of the Commander-in-Chief is to make sure that our mindset is not predisposed toward war, that our mindset is not predisposed toward regime change in a kind of casual fashion, that we have totally lost sight of the fact that we are an international republic that has obligations toward other nations' sovereignty as well. I think we've lost some sight of that. Whether Senator Obama is going to be the puppet of the left, whether we're the puppet of the right, I don't know. I take great pride in the fact that the Federalist Society has enormous influence on George W. Bush in terms of judicial appointments. Yes, I suspect a lot of people that I don't travel around with will have influence on Senator Obama on his judicial appointments. This is the consequence of our constitutional system. If you are given the constitutional office and you forfeit its responsibility by not performing, not taking care that the laws are faithfully and well executed, well, you lose that office and you lose that power. And the president then has the ability to reset the course in his direction. This is the consequence of our vote. This is the nature of our democratic system. So I see nothing nefarious in that. I see that as the constitutional plan working itself out. I have many other points that I could make, but I do want to take questions. And so the last point that I want to make is one that I think we need to, as a Federalist Society, think seriously about. In response to the Heller opinion, a number of us have written out of great concern, myself, Judge Posner, Judge Wilkinson, that in fact that was a test of fidelity of our commitment to original understanding. That was a test to see whether we were going to allow ideology to govern or we were going to allow the words as they existed at the time of their enactment and ratification to govern. This is Judge Posner's conclusion. In light of District of Columbia versus Heller, it is questionable in both, original understanding is now questionable in both method and result. It is evidence that the Supreme Court, in deciding constitutional cases, exercises a freewheeling discretion strongly flavored by ideology. Can't help but read that opinion and see that there were enormously well-reasoned historical cases presented by both the majority and the dissent. And to have a tie go to history means that you have the law running out. No surprise that you can go to legislative history, you can go to constitutional history and not come up with an answer. If you took a snapshot of this moment in time of 2008 as to what we believe about certain bedrock principles, we would get a survey of beliefs, not a singular belief. And if you take a picture of history, you often get a survey of belief as well, so you have to choose. And we pretend and we indulge in a very, very serious pretense that will weaken the role of original understanding if we oversell it. And Judge Wilkinson and Judge Posner have both written very thoughtful essays about not overselling original understanding. Because the notion that you can take the Second Amendment and simply drop off the first 13 words as prefatory, that you could in fact find within it a common law right to possess weapons for purposes unrelated to the militia, that you could associated with the reasons why people were concerned about the protection of the militia and not having it eviscerated by the right of militiamen to have the right to keep and bear arms as against government tyranny. If you could indulge in all those things, as Justice Scalia does, you don't honor his theory, you don't honor our theory and the integrity of the law outside of the human person. You weaken it. And this is not an old concern. It's as old as Blackstone. Blackstone explained, and this is, I quote, "The fairest and most rational method to interpret the will of the legislator is by exploring his intentions at the time when the law was made by signs the most natural and probable, and these signs are either the words, the context, the subject matter, and now get ready, Federalists, the effects and consequences, and the spirit and the reason of the law. To divide ourselves into hermetically sealed categories to suggest that original understanding is here and the effects and consequences of the law are over here is to allow the Breyers and the Souters and the Ginsburgs to get away with too much when they want to push consequences over words as enacted. To recognize that they both play a role is to give the strongest case for originalism." Thank you.
I thank you both, and I do see that it is 2 o'clock, so for those of you who need to leave, feel free to leave, but they have both been gracious to take some questions, so we're going to open it up to questions for a few minutes. I see a couple in the audience, which I'll start with.
I have a question for you, Doug, with respect to our comment. With respect to one of the things that you say you admire about Obama is that he would select a judge that is going to show empathy, seems to be an anathema to what our system is about, because we are a system of laws and of judges. And my concern about a president who would appoint someone based on empathy, maybe the easiest analogy, which I like to use when I'm in a courtroom, that everybody could understand, is it's like a parent wanting to be the friend of their children instead of imposing the laws, which we have decided. We've passed laws for a particular reason, and the court's rule is to interpret and have those laws enforced. And to say, in your example, the law ran out. The law ran out only from one person's side, and it's the empathetic side. It's the law ran out on this woman. The law didn't run out. The law was there, and there was a statute of limitations. And that statute of limitations was passed and has been respected for some reason or other. And a judge who has empathy is going to make a choice not based on all of the law in front of him, but in protecting one against the other, regardless of what the law tells us. But unless we are governed by a system of laws, our democracy is not going to be successful. We have to have objective and we have to have normative laws, which is always the problem that I have with the abortion debate. Because people, and you've said it too, as a good Catholic, I don't see it. I'm a Catholic or was raised Catholic. I don't see it as a Catholic issue. All of our laws are normative. We pass laws that prohibit stealing. And it doesn't matter if the woman who is stealing is a poor woman who, I mean, there's a story in the paper today in the Detroit News, which is supposedly our conservative paper. And it's written in a very sympathetic fashion that this woman stole from the Boy Scouts. Why? Because she wasn't able to make her mortgage payments and she wasn't able to do this. And it was written in almost a sympathetic fashion that, yes, we know this is wrong, but there are extenuating circumstances and therefore shouldn't we give her a break and isn't this okay? It isn't okay. I mean, our system is a system of law, which is the other problem that Obama is going to have, you know, that the American people are going to have to face under an Obama regime. And that is the notion of, I don't call it redistribution of wealth, I call it taking one person's earnings to help another person who doesn't earn that much. He's not talking about taking money from the wealthy to provide for someone who is mentally ill or incapable of supporting themselves. He wants to take the money from somebody who's earned more than the waitress because the waitress is not making enough money to live the way that somebody else is living. That's not what our system is. And while, you know, I mean, your arguments are all interesting and I have very much enjoyed talking to you, I don't see intellectually, and from an intellectual standpoint or an intellectually honest standpoint, how you can gel that with a Reaganist approach. approach to what our democracy is.
Well, just a brief response, and thank you, Susan, for that very thoughtful set of remarks. I think their thoughtfulness is enhanced upon the careful examination of each of the things that you mentioned, which, of course, we won't have time to do here. But my one brief response on the first point about empathy and the norms of law, there's no doubt about it. You and I are on the same page in terms of the norms of law. I believe Senator Obama is as well. I think the point he makes to us is the point that Judge Wilkinson and Posner makes about the Second Amendment example. And that is that the history did run out there. It didn't give an answer. And we had to invent or place emphasis on canons of interpretation that, in fact, nobody had used in centuries to resolve cases, and indeed were directly contrary to the precedent under the Miller case and all of the lower federal court cases that have followed Miller in that example. So I'm with you in terms of the general principle. I just think we do need to, and I'm also with you to the extent that you say that Senator Obama would use the empathy point to exempt us from the general principle, which would be wrong. My only caution as a federalist is to say in between that there's a truth in between both of those extremes. And the truth is that sometimes we make original understanding either of statute or constitutional provision seem as if it is too apparent when it's not that apparent. We make it seem too plain when it is not that plain. And we need to be more honest about the limitations of our interpretive ability. On abortion, boy, I've had this argument so many times now with Barack Obama, he's about to throttle me. But, I say to him over and over again, there's a right and wrong here. And it's not a question about, as you say, the poverty of the person to do wrong. That would be an illogical normative system. His response, and I don't have a good response to this, so if you've got a better one than I've been able to think up, I welcome it. His response really is about the pluralism of our religious belief. Because on this issue, I can say to him, as I do, this is an objective scientific fact, buddy. Pay attention to it. And he'll say, well, I'm sorry, it's more than an objective scientific fact. You're reading into the objective scientific fact a conclusion that the presence of all of the ingredients for human life in the first fertilized cell means, ipso facto, that this is human personhood in our society, when in fact other religious beliefs say, no, the born alive child is the human person in our society, and they believe that as a matter of revealed, in their scriptural sense, religious tradition, as much as you believe it, not only because of natural law, because of scientific fact, or because of the treatment of the apostles. And he wants to know from me, how do we impose one view over the other? And if we can't, then isn't the ultimate principle of federalism the one that should govern? And by that, he means the principle of federalism that puts it in the person, the sovereign of the person, as opposed to the sovereign of the state. That's, I think, a tougher argument to deal with than the one that we're normally given. And on the redistribution point, I'd only just say the words common defense. If he was a socialist, he'd not be getting any plaudits from me. The fact of the matter is that my income always falls right in that category that's too little to take advantage of all the tax breaks that George Bush enacted, and too much to take advantage of the ones that were presumably meant to immunize the working class. And so I've always felt like, what the heck am I doing in this nether world? Can't I move in one direction or the other? But there is an ethic in America that we do contribute to a common fund to provide for those public goods that otherwise can't be provided. I think that's what he's talking about.
If I may just add one comment on the abortion and the different faith traditions, I think it's probably easy to say that there have been different opinions in a lot of different faith traditions about such things as slavery, wife beating, honor killings. Different faith traditions have different opinions about all those things. It doesn't stop us or any other civilized society from making a judgment. It has nothing to do with sectarianism, picking one faith tradition over another, but as we say, it's natural law, it's biology, it's human rational capacity. That's what's involved in making decisions about abortion. I think it is really sophistry of the worst kind, and I wish I could sit down with Senator Obama when he's posing that, what you are considering a tough answer. I don't think it's tough at all. I think that it's just a huge red herring to say that this is picking one faith tradition over another, when we make similar decisions all the time that have nothing to do with any sectarian faith decision. And just quickly on the Heller situation, I mean, I don't think the law ran out there. Maybe Justice Scalia's opinion is not the exact one that I would have written, but I would say that, you know, there is a clear text in the Second Amendment, that all of the rights in the Bill of Rights are individual rights. If you look at the structure of the Bill of Rights, if you look at the purpose, you look at what it was doing, there are all sorts of canons of interpretation and ways of looking at it that are using the law and not just tossing up your hands and saying that the law ran out.
Thank you, Rangel. And I'm sorry I have to leave after this question, but Professor Kamek, I wonder if you could respond to this. You set forth the framework in which you believe that Alito and Roberts are the type of justices you would want on the Supreme Court. Barack Obama would never support those two justices. So on the issue of justices to the Supreme Court, how can you support Barack Obama?
Well, you know, isn't it this way for all of us in terms of that we cast our vote for candidates that are not in 100% agreement with us, right? We try and get as much agreement as we can. Yes, I've told him that he's mistaken about Justice Thomas, and I've chatted that he's mistaken about Roberts and Alito as well, that I know these men more than he knows these men, and as a result, we cast a mistaken vote. Fact of the matter is that I think his point of empathy, as I've just said, has a role to play in the clinches, in the very tough cases where one can find that empathetic concern in the original intent of the Congress, in the original drafter of the proposition. I don't think you can just impose it for outcome purposes. But the honest answer, Matthew, on judges is I wouldn't select Senator Obama for that as my primary reason for President of the United States. As I began the debate, the one place where W didn't lose faith with me was on that. If he had conducted the rest of his presidency in the way that he had adhered to the appointment of judges, we wouldn't be in this position right now. So.
Brad, I see your question, but I have a follow-up for that I think would be good to ask Wendy, and then I'll get to your question. Wendy, one question I had was, Sean McCain, as you've spoken, and as he's pointed out before, is quite apt to say that, you know, he would like to put, people like Alito and Court. But I have an intellectual curiosity about that, when the fact that if you look at John McCain's long tenure in the Senate, his linchpin benchmark rule legislation that everybody knows about right now is McCain-Feingold. And if you look at who voted against McCain-Feingold at the court, obviously it was before Alito and Roberts were there, it questions whether or not, to me, intellectually, how McCain can say that when the people who he claims he's going to put on the bench would have gotten rid of his number one legislative decision in the last 20 years. So,
well, Obama has the same problem in that he will criticize the opinions that have been issued by Ginsburg and the rest of them. So they both have that problem. I would say, obviously, McCain was wrong with McCain-Feingold, no doubt about it. And I'm glad he has better wisdom when it comes to picking justices. And I'm certainly, certainly glad about that. But I think that if I had to choose between the two, I'd rather have him pass a bad statute and give us good Supreme Court justices who are going to have way more impact on this country and the Constitution than one bad statute, which can hopefully be corrected.
Sure. Okay, good question.
Professor, many of us are very depressed about the idea of Broadway, and Federalists in particular. So I'm happy for you that you're happy. He's going to
his penis.
But the idea of the Supreme Court, Catherine McCain in Word Article in the Wall Street Journal, talking about how she endorses Obama for precisely the opposite reason that you enunciated today, that he's going to appoint results-driven judges, and this is what we need, is to have results-driven judges and abandon this pretense of trying to follow the original intent in the law. And here's my question. That was the setup. Here's the question. How confident are you? You know him better than any of us. How confident are you that he's not going to appoint purely results-driven jurists?
Well, I could say I was as confident as I was in the presidency of George W. Bush, but that wouldn't be the statement that you would want to hear. But that may be the honest statement. You know, you're only confident as far as the representations that people make to you. I am confident of this, Brad, that he is a person of intelligence, that he is a person that I think does have respect for our constitutional system and the rule of law. I don't think he has a schedule of results that he can see into the future with that he's going to be capable of implementing up through his appointments. I don't think any president has that ability. There's no question but that our constitutional system here depends upon not just the president's nomination, but the voices in the Senate. Now, one of my bigger fears is not the fear of the presidency, but what's going on out there in the Senate and the House races. Now, I don't know the answer to that. My friend at lunch, Mr. Grano, was part of the electoral process this past year, and he has a better sense of how electoral districts have been drawn and so forth and what that means for outcomes. I'm hoping it will mean that many of the people that I respect who are currently in the Senate will be returning to the Senate, but I don't know that for a fact. But I think our constitutional system depends upon that check. All I can say is I do have the faith that he's a person of integrity. I do have the faith of this, and this is important. I've never seen a political candidate invite people of opposing views as often to come in and test his views. I mean, the number of times in which other presidential candidates have brought into a room over and over again during the primary and during the general election campaign people who are deliberately on record to be in opposition to him and then say to them, give me your best shot. Give me your best argument. Tell me where my argument is wrong. Is somebody who's got the capacity, I think, to do great good if the American people hold him to that. Of course, we're the ultimate guarantors of accountability, are we not? And I think that's where we're at. And the fact that our incumbent put us in this weakened position, that we aren't in a stronger position to have more than that, is the reality of democracy.
Any other questions?
I have one just final question.
Or comment, and then I see a question.
Actually, this is a question for Doug, which is, Doug, how can you defend or explain to us Barack Obama's behavior and statements on the Born Alive Infant Protection Act in Illinois? How he first said that he voted against it because it lacked the neutrality clause that the federal bill had. Then when National Right to Life essentially proved him wrong and put up on his website the documents showing that at least the second version did, he kind of trenched back on that. And then in the third presidential debate, he said, oh, it's because there was already an existing law in the books. Again, that's completely false. The law he's referring to was the 1975 Illinois abortion statute that patently did not protect infants in this situation. And that was the real reason that they were being put in the linen closets to die and why there was an impetus for the bill in the first place.
Wendy, great question. And the fact of the matter is, as you know, it's indefensible because it's the underlying procedure is indefensible. Abortion is indefensible. So if you're going to defend the Born Alive actions of the senator, you have to defend abortion. I don't defend abortion, so I don't defend the senator's Born Alive proposition. But see, that's the difference between the two of us and between a large part of the American public and us on the issue of abortion. Once abortion has become legal and has been acknowledged as the woman's choice, Obama's proposition is, well, then you don't come in and recriminate against her with this redefinition of the concept of born alive. Now, what I've
in the book, available at bookstores near you, in the book is the full tale, as best as I could sort it out, and it's a pretty convoluted tale, and there's, even without buying the book, you can go on the Chicago Tribune website. There is the reporter who covered it and who has a very detailed blog of the day-by-day events. The one thing that clearly was happening was a change in the definition of born alive, right? The definition of born alive is most commonly associated with, well, born alive. That you are at the end term of the pregnancy and the child is capable of surviving, without the umbilical connection to his mother. That's the definition of born alive. It's the definition that is in the county recorder's offices for the most part in terms of recording life and death. In many counties, maybe not all, in many counties, if a miscarriage occurs, the child who miscarried is not counted as born alive in the context of the statute. Now, Senator Obama made an effort. How sufficient the effort was, I'm not prepared to say because I can't tell from the cold record or from my conversations with him, to ask the drafters of this legislation to return it to the definition of born alive as it existed in common law. But, of course, that would have defeated the whole purpose of why they had the legislation. So they refused to do that. He refused to sign on when they refused to do that. And the bottom line is this for me, and that's, as I say in the book, if I was in the Illinois legislature next to Barack Obama, I would have said, look, if there's a one in a zillionth chance that some child might survive out of this, vote for it. It's not going to kill you. But it might kill the child. So that would be my advice. But my advice is premised upon what? My advice is premised on the belief that life begins at conception and that the Declaration of Independence was meant to be implemented by the Constitution of the United States and that insofar as Roe v. Wade exists and there will forever be a breach between the Declaration and the Constitution. And when the Republicans run a candidate who's prepared to enforce the Declaration of Independence under the Constitution of the United States, I will be first in line to support him. And when the President of the United States nominates Wendy, who I suspect would be prepared to see that connection between the Declaration and the Constitution, because the fine man she clerked for, Clarence Thomas, is the only justice on the Supreme Court who sees that connection, I'll be the first to write a letter of overwhelming support for my opponent in this debate. So,
I'll get to your question in a second. I just have a quick follow-up for that, because you were talking about Senator Obama's explanation or rationale for his abortion position is the different faith, religious background and faith we have in this country, and that's one of the things he uses. And Wendy, I think, gave you some comments that you can take back to the senator with regard to other things that other religions would abhor that we have outlawed. But how does the Born Alive legislation fit into those different faith bases?
Randy, they don't really get, the faith argument doesn't really play much into it in terms of, you really then have to fall back on this definitional issue of born alive, and it's no better than what I described it as. The only other factor that was in the mix was that the Illinois Medical Society opposed the legislation as well, but they had a conflict of interest. They were going to be held more likely to be liable if they didn't provide services, and so doctors always minimize their risk. Who wouldn't? And that's why they voted against it. So I don't think the religious argument changes the other answer.
And I see we have two questions left, so let's get yours first, and then we'll go to Jared.
One quick question. Comment is, it seems that I've heard of all of Obama's arguments before in Bill Clinton by saying he wants it safe, legal, but rare. The question is, with regard to, as a Catholic who has gone public, who endorses a candidate who does not believe in the personhood of unborn children, which is, as you say, intrinsically opposed to our definition of when human life begins, there's also a theory in the church that by going public like that, it's outside of the private norms where you go into the ballot box and say, well, I don't like either candidate, it's a messy situation, I'm going to vote for the one because my examination of conscience says that I've got to vote for one candidate that still might work for the right to life independently. How are you not, or how is anyone who goes public not committing a scandal or furthering a scandal within the church by endorsing such a candidate?
Well, of course, there's a view that I have. I was denied communion from a priest by virtue of my endorsement. That was perhaps the most publicly humiliating experience of my life. And to walk up at the communion line and hold your hand out and be told, no, I can't receive because you're unworthy and you're sinful and you're scandalous. It's not an experience I wish on anyone else. It was an experience that I kept to myself when it happened, and it didn't become public until 2 months later when, and I don't say this with any desire for vengeance, but it became public at the hands of Republican partisans who decided that they were going to use me as the poster boy to say, if you endorse Barack Obama, this is the penalty you will receive. So beware. Now, the good news here from the standpoint of my faith is that my ordinary, Cardinal Mahoney, called the priest in, heard his explanation as to what he thought his thinking was. Cardinal Mahoney found the explanation of the priest to be so wholly wanting in terms of the canon law of the church that he directed the priest to either write us, my wife and myself, a letter of apology, or to be, in essence, de-licensed from being capable of being a priest in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. So I told the cardinal that I had forgiven the man in my heart, and that it was not for me that he had to intervene. He said, it's not for you, buddy. It's for the good of the church that I'm intervening. Now, how did the cardinal reach that conclusion? Because you raised an important question as to how to understand that in terms of the larger teaching of the church. The bishops tell us in their call to faithful citizenship document, and I think it's paragraph 42, that Catholics are not to be single-issue voters, that they're supposed to consider the whole social gospel in terms of the casting of the vote. But they have this other very important sentence, and this is the sentence that people sort of get tangled in, that a Catholic voter may, notice the permissive, may legitimately disqualify a candidate on the basis of his support for an intrinsic evil, which of course abortion is. Now, here's the question then. What do you do with the permissive verb may? Because it also includes the statement that you may legitimately disqualify him, but of course you may legitimately qualify him. And indeed, Cardinal Ratzinger told us that in his commentary from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith in 2004. What you need to qualify him in order to stay in the good graces of the Church is a proportionate reason. And the proportionate reason, here's where there's a matter of individual conscience, and people have seen it differently. Archbishop Chaput of Denver, who's written a very fine book, competes with mine, so I'll mention it, Render Unto Caesar, is a wonderful book, comes to the exact opposite conclusion than I do, but uses the same method. So the exact opposite conclusion depends on how you see the conscience working in terms of the totality of the social gospel. Archbishop Chaput says, I weigh 40 million unborn deaths against anything else, and the anything else loses. And that's an entirely respectable view. But if that's the view, it sort of is at odds with, as I see it, with Cardinal Ratzinger, because Cardinal Ratzinger again said, you can vote for a pro-choice candidate if you have proportionate reason to do so. But the proportionate reason has to be serious. You have to believe it's serious. I believe the addressing of the inequity in our economic system, our health system, the manner in which we've conducted the war, is of that degree of seriousness. But that, even that, I'm sorry, I don't know your first name.
Charles.
Charles. Even that, Charles, would not have been enough for me. It was the thing that put it just barely over the top was Obama saying, I view abortion as a tragic moral choice. I view it as something that I would want to discourage. and going to his own party, which you know is not a party that is inclined to this belief, saying to his NARAL constituency, okay, you have your reaffirmation in the party platform of Roe, but I'm adding two paragraphs. One paragraph deals with expenditures to encourage age-appropriate education for young people so that we try and reduce abortion in terms of reducing the number of unwanted pregnancies by simple immaturity or lack of knowledge. But the second was the one that I gave emphasis to in the talk, and that is the support for people in their parishes or whatever entity they work through for prenatal and to offer pregnant women in bad circumstance prenatal and postnatal care or maternity funding. I know, Charles, this works in my own life because someone I love more than anyone else on this earth, my spouse, has dedicated her life to being a counselor in this way for young women who have unwanted pregnancies. And more often than not, when Carol is able to have a conversation, they come to her saying, you know, their mind is made up, they're going to have the abortion, they can't tell their parents, et cetera, the guilt, the shame, the whole thing. Carol walks them back one sentence at a time and says, what are you concerned about? Well, I'm concerned about dropping out of school. I'm concerned about not living in the dormitory. I'm concerned about not having a job. And then she says, quite thoughtfully, I can handle all that. What else are you concerned about? And then sometimes we hear, I'm just too young. I don't think I can raise a child. And Carol says, I can handle that too. I know plenty of couples that would want to take that child from you and who would honor you for the gift that you gave to them. And almost to a person, can't say to every person because there have been some tragedies along the way, but almost to a person, that meager effort out of our own resources has made a difference, the principle of subsidiarity in Catholic thought. My belief is that Senator Obama is sincere about bringing federal resources into the orbit of people like Mike Carroll. And if that's the case, she will be more effective, and others like her will be more effective. And we do have studies. I never like studies because studies can be manipulated one way or the other, but we do have studies that say there are real reductions in the incidence of abortion when you do address these circumstances. So that's what, for me, I offer as to my own conscience as trying to remain faithful to my church. And I'm told, you know, that not every bishop in my church sees it the same way, but a good number of bishops do.
Doug, I don't know which organization Carol works with, but as I understand it, Senator Obama essentially wants to defund crisis pregnancy centers for offering this pro-life alternative. I mean, it certainly is an article of faith in the pro-abortion community, and it's my understanding that Senator Obama has taken that position and wishes to defund pro-life crisis pregnancy
centers. The word crisis pregnancy center has a kind of...
Well, use a different term.
No, that's right. It's the term that he's objecting to, because there is, in fact, some centers that are less devoted to the actual care of a person than a kind of the advocacy of a particular idea. I don't have a problem with either one, but he draws that distinction, and he wants to create a new entity, life support entity, parenting entity, that will bring together all of these services, that will bring together the adoption services, that will bring together the healthcare services, and that will be available. He just wants to free himself from the old terminology. I think that's all that exists there.
Jerry, if you can keep your question to 10 seconds, and hopefully they'll keep their answers to 30 seconds.
Okay.
Impossible.
Doug, if I heard you before, in answer to one of the questions that I've been read, you mentioned that you thought Senator Obama supports the rule of law. But I also heard you at the beginning, when you mentioned the criteria that he applied, empathy for minorities was one of the criteria he replied to justice. And then we heard
It was within the statute, Jerry. You know, if in fact the purpose of the statute was to give remedy, and in a way, you know, the empathy that we're talking about is the empathy of the statute. Blackstone called it the equity of the statute. it exists in every statute, said Blackstone. I think it does in terms of the purpose of the law. It's not something he can come and graft onto the law out of his own personal view. If that's what he has in mind for empathy, and I'm not with him on that.
Okay, I was going to type that.
But then you wouldn't need empathy because the law, the text of the law itself would take care of it.
Well, except you need empathy in the Ledbetter case because you've got precedent that's going in both directions, and at some point you've got to flip a coin as to which one is the better judgment.
Okay, I'm going to have to sound like a wonderful place to stop.